Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right, well, The Heat and the Fury, on the front lines of climate violence, out now through Island Press. Peter Schwartzstein joins me on the program to discuss it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael.
So I want to start, before the book starts, with your getting into environmental journalism. Because as you write, it wasn't necessarily a topic you covered until you said you moved to Egypt. And what was it about moving to Egypt that led you to this specific field of journalism?
Absolutely. I mean, I've always loved being outdoors, but like many people have not necessarily been deeply engaged with kind of the nature of that wilderness. So for me, there was sort of two things that kind of were key to my transition from being a political correspondent to someone working in the environment. And the first was a sort of, I guess, more of an economic consideration. I was sort of all of a sudden competing, having kind of finished my journalism traineeship, against these sort of established staff correspondents with their kind of retinue of assistants. And I just simply couldn't compete, while also sort of, I guess, almost boring myself while writing kind of less good variations of what they were. But then, as if not more importantly, I mean, the longer that I worked in these sort of often kind of out of the way rural communities in along the Nile Valley, the more I realized how swiftly the local and kind of wider regional environment was deteriorating, and most importantly, perhaps how little attention at either kind of a media level or crucially among politicians was being directed towards sort of covering what was going on. And then, I mean, the more that I kind of delved into the environmental angle, the more I realized sort of how much one could tell the story of a place by looking at it through the prism of its environmental issues. I mean, why, for example, does Iraq, perhaps the regional country in which I've worked most, why does Iraq have water problems? Well, really, it's the same reason why Iraq has problems across the board. It's the legacy of conflict. It's meddling by kind of countries near and far. And it's corruption and mismanagement. So really, you can tell the story of a place almost better by looking at it through the lens of its environmental troubles than you can through a kind of relatively superficial look at its politics.
So with that, then, you go into Iraq and you're as you write, you know, recording, reporting, and asking very different questions than the political reporters, but you are getting at a deeper political issue at the same time as you're exploring the environmental problems.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I guess because I came at this from a sort of political correspondent, kind of political science student background, I was sort of forever looking to kind of show how intimately connected my sort of old beat was with my new one. Now, I mean, of course, there's that old line about kind of when you have a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. So there's a degree of self-selection. But ultimately, the more that I was working in kind of different parts of the environment space, the more overlap I realized there was. I mean, so many of the sort of security troubles, the car bombs, the political assassinations that had been sort of key, if not sort of deeply unfortunate parts of my kind of previous journalistic guise, all of a sudden seemed as if they could be in some way at least sort of caused by so many of these kind of wider environmental and climate furies that I was now looking at. So I quite quickly realized that the overlap between my past life and at that point my new one was pretty profound.
Right, as you write, the denuded trees or the like tree stumps, the fact that those were cut down because Saddam Hussein was worried about snipers hiding in the trees.
Sorry, I cut you off there.
Yeah, no, snipers hiding in the trees, and that there was an environmental repercussion to those actions that was caused by a political decision.
Exactly. So, I mean, whether you're in rural parts of Iraq, rural parts of Syria, rural parts of Egypt, so much of the kind of denuded, often quite sorry state of the natural landscape, and so much of the, vastly insufficient degrees of climate action can be sort of intimately tied up with the kind of overall political scene. When you've got an autocratic government in Baghdad, as of course one did for 30 something years in the lead up to Saddam's toppling in 2003, then I mean that almost invariably has the same kind of negative ramifications for the natural landscape as it does for the citizens of the country.
So you're doing you know, daily, weekly, that kind of reporting, at what point does this book start to take shape for you? Like, was there a specific thing that, you know, prompted you to think, I want to tell this as a larger story rather than these kind of like one-offs that I've been doing?
Oof. I mean, I think from a while ago, I was sort of maybe joking in a mostly joking way about how lovely it would be to sort of have your name emblazoned across the front cover of a book. But yeah, there's a few, I couldn't really sort of signpost precisely when I was keen to sort of launch into this, but certainly there's a few things that have kind of gone into it. One is that whenever you're writing an article of any sort, you're really meant to end up with, if you've done it right, at least with enough material to write an article two or three times longer than that which you ultimately do. And as a consequence, I ended up having huge amounts of what I deemed to be really interesting kind of untold stories that I was sort of loath to kind of leave on the cutting room floor, not least because so much of the time you're taking the time, you're taking the energy of farmers, perhaps, who would kind of much rather have spent that half an hour tilling their field than talking to me. And the very fact then that I would not even use the kind of fascinating and often sort of rather troubling stories that they'd told me didn't sit well with me. But equally, as I kind of moved into this sort of climate security nexus, as I did going back maybe 7, 8, 9 years, it also occurred to me that the nature of media wasn't particularly well suited to sort of telling the story of this nexus. And that's because even if you're writing in a kind of concise, pithy manner, you're often not granted the kinds of word counts necessary to kind of clarify a connection that's as knotty and as complicated as that between climate change and violence. So it's only really by putting together this kind of 300-page odd thing that I think I could do justice to the stories and ultimately justice to the nature of this climate conflict nexus.
So the shape of the book is, as you explained in the introduction, you know, there's kind of like regions and issues within each chapter, but that you look at it as a whole. Like, was that something that in looking back at your own reporting you saw, or did you develop that when you decided to sit down and write an actual book? Like, how did the shape of the book come to be?
I think up to a point I got a little bit lucky. I mean, when the idea of writing a book sort of really sort of clarified itself in my mind, and I kind of searched around desperately trying to work out what kind of existing reporting and research I already had. There was already the kind of bare bones of a narrative. There was the bare bones of a chapter structure. But then, I guess in the 2 or 3 years leading up to the beginning of 2023, when I really sort of sat myself down at a desk and focused on this for about 18 odd months, it was only then that I realized I probably had to be quite a lot more targeted and quite a lot more, smarter in how I went about filling those kind of holes in the narrative. So I would sort of look to persuade my editors to sort of send me to X place or send me back to X place to kind of flesh out some of those holes. Equally, when I felt that there were stories that were super important but that were not told at all, I would sort of angle to go to new places. And then, I mean, it was last year while I was mostly deskbound that I realized that despite my best efforts, there were still a few areas where I simply didn't have enough information, a few chapters centered on countries where I'd worked maybe a good deal less than in others. And in those instances, I decided I simply had to go back, for example, to Bangladesh. I had to go back to Nepal. I had to go back to the Sahel region of West Africa to kind of round out those holes. So a little bit of good luck mixed in with a degree of kind of belated planning.
So was it on the repeat trip to Nepal to the Indrawadi municipality that they gave you the glaring looks when you were asking questions?
Yes. Yeah, that was on my, third visit to Nepal, where I was sort of looking for a little bit of a kind of positive upside to so much of the kind of miserable the misery. And as you allude to, there was a kind of unhappy bent to what is nevertheless, I guess, a slightly optimistic tale there.
Had you conceived of that chapter as being like kind of the last chapter and a quote-unquote hopeful one before going to Nepal and looking at that through a hopeful lens, or did you in visiting Nepal feel more hopeful coming out of that?
No, I mean, just for the sake of your listeners, I mean, there's this kind of area called the Indrawati Rural Municipality, which is this group of sort of cluster of extremely scenic looking villages probably about 3,000 meters up in the Himalayas. So, I mean, high for almost anywhere but Nepal. And despite the kind of the picture perfect nature of what they look like, there was intense levels of poverty, intense levels of kind of interpersonal violence, much of it targeted against women and a lot of it between these disparate villages. And it was as I was exploring that I understood that actually there had been a good deal more violence previously that some kind of savvy local leadership had sort of addressed. So no, I stumbled on that totally by accident. Now, I had always intended to sort of end the book with a kind of moderately optimistic chapter, partly because, yeah, most of the book is admittedly not doesn't make for particularly happy reading. And I just sort of wanted to ensure that one didn't kind of leave it as deeply dispirited as the kind of previous chapters might warrant, but also because it's important to tell the full story of environment and climate's interaction with security. And it's not all bad news. Like, as we see in this particular part of Nepal and in many other parts of the world, environmental troubles can be harnessed in such a way as to reduce local tension, sometimes resolve them entirely, sometimes kind of prevent forms of violence that would have broken out in the first place. So it's, yeah, this is not kind of an unequivocal tale of doom and gloom.
Right. Like a shared problem can unite people rather than divide them. And you do point to some instances. You raise the topic of environmental peacekeeping in that chapter. And I guess it's maybe a phrase I hadn't heard before, but a topic that, as you point out, isn't necessarily new, right? Like that the EU as it stands today kind of came about through like a collectivist effort for the environment. And that, you know, there was efforts like this during the height of the Cold War between the US and Russia.
Definitely. I mean, there's been an understanding, as you allude to, going back quite a few decades, that environment and water issues can be at least partly divorced from kind of a messy wider dynamic. I mean, as we also saw this in the kind of US-Iran relationship in the lead up to the nuclear deal in 2015. And that's because up to a point, there's a recognition that this cannot and in most hands should not be a zero-sum game. Now, one can question whether kind of environmental issues really are sort of quote-unquote softer in a way that they're sometimes presented. I mean, particularly when we enter this sort of more complicated era of sort of relative resource scarcity in places, environment and climate and wider water issues are anything but a kind of softer issue there. But there does still seem to be something of a willingness to kind of set aside environment and water from otherwise sort of messy dynamics.
Yeah, you mentioned whether they are really softer. And I think in the West, the chapter on the West, the one that precedes the final chapter, you talk about green colonialism and that, you know, that this specter of the West trying to address climate change through, you know, like EVs and things like that means mining for cobalt, or like that there's a lot of contemporary versions of colonialism in terms of resource extraction and whether it will heighten things rather than, you know, make them better. Or like the fact that I think you start that chapter with the test on cloud seeding in Mexico. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that forms part of my kind of West-centered chapter. And no, certainly, I mean, the ways in which the kind of maneuvers we make, the moves we make to sort of try and address climate change, to try and wean ourselves off oil and gas, as you say, can in some instances and in plenty of instances are contributing to additional volleys of violence. No, that doesn't have to be the case. There are ways in which we can secure the kind of materials that will be kind of critical to kind of a post fossil fuels economy without the kinds of human and environmental suffering that have emerged out of, well, both Western and non-Western attempts to secure these minerals. But it's just an illustration of the kind of perils of either poorly implemented or sort of ill-conceived in the first place forms of climate action. And that kind of feeds into a broader story. I mean, there's the idea that kind of the green transition is an untrammeled good. And certainly it's absolutely necessary, of course, for all the reasons that you and your listeners undoubtedly know. But there will be trade-offs. There will be losers or relative losers in the process. There will be chunks of the natural landscape that most likely will need to be studied to a certain extent in our pursuit of these minerals. And it's a question of whether that kind of deeply unfortunate series of trade-offs can be done in a way that doesn't just bleed into additional rounds of instability, particularly in poor countries.
You'd mentioned earlier about, taking a farmer's time and then maybe leaving much of what they said on the cutting room floor when it came to an article and wanting to kind of go back and expand on things. In terms of relationship building and getting what you need for an article or for this book out of people who are, in the throes of climate uncertainty, that how difficult is that part of the thing for you?
It's been simultaneously one of the hardest parts and of course one of the most rewarding parts. I mean, a lot of journalists, maybe myself included, sometimes have a pompous tendency to sort of refer to our job as something of a calling. I mean, but above all else, in my case at least, I do this because it gives me a fascinating opportunity to just meet all sorts of people who I wouldn't perhaps otherwise have an opportunity to engage with in kind of far-flung places that are not necessarily easy to visit. Now, so much of my work, as you alluded to, has centered on farmers. I mean, they're the ones who are most acutely vulnerable to climate stress, and they're the ones who are kind of, for an array of reasons, so often at the heart of this kind of climate violence story. And I've ended up having to spend, very large chunks of the past 11 or 12 years in these sort of out-of-the-way parts of kind of rural Sudan, rural Burkina Faso, rural Syria, and so on. And that's partly because in order to sort of really illustrate how climate change and instability fits together, you've got to spend long periods of time with the afflicted communities, seeing where climate change fits into this kind of messy mosaic of other things going on in their life. It's only through that method, as far as I'm concerned, that one can kind of understand the precise nature of climate's contribution to instability. It's rewarding, as I said, but of course it also means extended periods on the road, sort of away from my family. It's meant periodic kind of run-ins with trouble. As my mother is finding to her horror right now, as she sort of reads the book for the first time, there are all sorts of very messy experiences that I had over that past 11 or 12 years that I was sort of wise enough to never previously tell her about. And even in the book, I go a little bit light on them. I mean, this is a story that's not easy to tell.
So when you roll over the IED, she didn't know about that story before?
She didn't, and it's deeply unfortunate as far as I'm concerned that she needs to know now.
The farmers, as you point out in the book, very often, not very often, some of the issues are, the result of agricultural use, the environmental impact on it. And sometimes it's, a decision being made elsewhere, right? The hoarding of water for a city or a metropolitan area versus, the water needed to irrigate or feed and water the grazing cattle. It's a very complex and knotty thing where, there's a resource hoarding that's happening in some of these situations that either is impacting them through someone else far away's decisions or right across the river. And so the violence that comes as a result of this, as you point out, is much more about inequity than mm-hmm. anything else.
Definitely. Think of climate change as kind of basically amplifying a lot of a society's existing weaknesses. So if, as is the case in most countries, you have varying degrees of inequality, what climate change does much of the time is it exacerbates them. So yeah, this can take the form, as you said, of kind of cities, as is the case in a lot of poorer parts of the world, but also some of the richer parts of the world, which kind of guarantee their own water needs at the expense of kind of farming communities in more peripheral areas. What we see in a country like Iran, for example, is the government has been trying to pipe water from some of the kind of relatively well-watered areas to those which are almost totally parched. And surprise, surprise, many farmers that are in the areas that are losing that water are ardently opposed to this, and have in some instances looked to sabotage those pipelines, carrying away what they deem to be their water and their water alone. Climate change is absolutely exacerbating inequality in its many different forms. And the way in which that perhaps crops up most often in the book is the ways in which climate change is hobbling agriculture in a way that it's mostly not hobbling the kinds of jobs that we have, mostly not hobbling the kinds of jobs that we have in urban workplaces. And that's kind of just adding to the already kind of yawning gulf between kind of urban and rural incomes, which, as I set out, particularly in chapter one, the Iraq chapter, appears to have been one of the forces that kind of most energetically contributed to ISIS's success in recruitment.
Right. That was, you know, a very bracing thing to read, that like it created a situation that made it very easy for these people to want to take arms.
Yes. I mean, just to kind of feed, to maybe flesh out that example, I found over the course of this kind of 3 or 4 year long period in which I was trying to show or sort of illustrate how ISIS had profited from collapsing agricultural conditions to pad its ranks, I found that some of the greatest concentrations of ISIS recruitment came from the villages on the kind of periphery of Mosul, this large city in northern Iraq. And that's that because even though a lot of those particular villages were by no means the poorest of the poor, they were nevertheless acutely aware, living so up close to their urban peers, of the ever-increasing disparity between their livelihoods and those of the urbanites. And that strong sense of the kind of deepening inequality, mixed in with many other grievances and many resentments, gave ISIS recruiters, when they came along, a pretty devastating bunch of tools to leverage.
And as you quote a anonymous tribal leader, angry people can do crazy things.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm going to be back in Iraq for much of January, looking to kind of tease out that particular part, because so much of the time when I'm working in rural parts of, for example, Burkina Faso or Iraq or Syria, and I'm talking to those who've been engaged in different forms of climate-related violence, or the relatives or neighbors of people who've been engaged in this kind of thing, they really, really struggle to articulate quite why, for example, they joined X jihadi group, or why they, I don't know, attacked a neighboring village in circumstances that couldn't possibly benefit them. And I think a lot of it is kind of related to both the direct and indirect forms of trauma that climate change is contributing to. So, for example, the very fact that birds are not migrating when they previously did, the very fact that plants are not blooming during the periods of the year when they were before, most importantly, of course, the fact that rainfall is so horribly out of whack, along with many other factors, is seemingly giving rise to a lot of pretty wild, pretty deranged, pretty irrational, and sometimes violent behavior.
And the possibility of a future wild behavior is there too, as you point out, you know, about Greece, and I think it's a fishing captain who talks about like the fact that the fish patterns, like where they hatch and breed, are out of whack, and it's putting them into territory where it's Greece and Turkey have already had contested waters, and that like there's the future has more hotspots in it.
It does. It's got many more. I mean, most of the book, as I explained, is centered on the experience of poorer parts of the world, and there's a good reason for that. I mean, those are the parts of the world that are experiencing most of the most intense climate-related stress, and those are the ones with much of the worst governance, and it's the fusion of the two that is almost always responsible for climate-related violence. But bit by bit, we are starting to see the beginnings of various forms of climate-related violence within our own sort of largely richer parts of the world. And I mean, I live in Greece, hence the slightly Greece-heavy nature of the West chapter. And I come out with two particular examples, maybe more than two, of how this is playing out in Greece. The first one you mentioned, it's that because of warming waters in the Mediterranean, a lot of these kind of prized, extremely lucrative stocks of tuna have changed their migration patterns. And they're actually passing in a kind of very unhappy series of circumstances through a bunch of these contested islets that Greece and Turkey have almost gotten to war for over in the past. And that's ensuring that a lot of these fishermen and their respective coast guards are coming into ever more dangerous, ever more frequent interaction around those contested islets. But I also look at a lot of work that I've been doing in bits and pieces over the past 2 years on how extreme heat is contributing to greater degrees of violence against women. Now, I center this on Athens, but we have a wealth of evidence showing that violence against women in its many different forms almost always surges during or immediately after various forms of climate stress. I mean, after Hurricane Beryl in Texas in June or July of this year, there was something like a 200 or 300% increase in calls to women's shelter hotlines. So by kind of telling this tale, trying to show that in smallish or increasingly non-smallish ways, this is a form of violence that we too will feel in richer countries.
Well, unfortunately, it's an all too apt title then, The Heat and the Fury. On the front lines of climate violence out through Island Press, Peter Schwarzstein, thanks very much for taking some time to join me on the program to talk about the book, and congratulations on its release.
Thank you very much. I'm very grateful for you to having me on.